We have been looking at the Dharma through using symbols and stories. And for the last little bit, and for the future little bit, we've been using this as a structure, Sangharakshita's system of meditation, or system of spiritual development, integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. And we spent quite a lot of time looking at the subject of integration. So we've seen a really important foundation is to bring, as it were, bring our different selves together, to create a sort of harmonized, unified self that can really be effective, bring all our energies together. So we've looked at that. And now we're moving on to this second stage, positive emotion. I say it's the second stage, but it's not really separate. It's not as though you do one and then you do the other. We need to be working on them both at the same time. They really sort of feed into each other. And they really, in a way, they sort of map onto the two basic meditations that we teach. So the mindfulness of breathing is an excellent way of sort of bringing bits of ourselves together, integrating ourselves, focusing ourselves. And the mind and the metta bhavana is an excellent way of generating positive emotions. So that's why we teach those meditations sort of initially as the foundation of the path. So I have to admit that I got my wires slightly crossed with Vegetarian because I've been away for a while. And I thought I was kicking off the section on positive emotion. And she's actually already given a talk on it. But never mind, because what you're going to get from me is an introduction. So, you know, it's postmodernist. We don't do it in order. So what I'm going to do is, so we're going to have a little series on positive emotion before we move on to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And I was down to do a talk on Tonglen, which is a meditation practice, the story of Tonglen meditation practice. But that would have involved actually doing some meditation. It would have involved mixing the talk with meditation. And this place just isn't really suitable for that just at the moment. So I'm going to change it. It's one reason I'm going to change it. And another reason I'm going to change it is I think we just need a bit of an introduction. I don't think it's right to just plunge in. So although we've already plunged, we're now going to have the introduction. So what I've called this talk is Asanga and the what, why and how of positive emotion. So what, why and how. And I'm going to tell a story about Asanga to illustrate. So what, why and how. What do we mean by positive emotion? Why do we need to practice it? Why is it there at the beginning of a path? And how do we develop it? And how don't we develop it as well? How do we avoid, you know, what sort of pitfalls are there? So that's the sort of subject I'm going to look at. What, why, and how. So first of all, what? Well, okay, you could probably all come up with your own list. So here's one, partly based on tradition, but there's no way it's an inclusive list about positive and negative emotions. It sort of gets us started and it will illustrate it. You might not be able to see it, but so I'll run through it. So I've got here positives and sort of negatives that might go together. So a positive emotion, I've got metta, and a negative one, I've got ill will. A positive emotion, I've got compassion. And a negative one, I've got cruelty, or actually enjoying others' misfortunes. Taking joy in others' misfortunes. Here I've got, third one is joy in others' good fortune, or joy in others' happiness. And the opposite of that being envy, jealousy. I've got generosity as a positive, and greed and avarice as a negative. I've got what we call sraddha, which is faith, trust, confidence, as a positive. You can come up with lots of negatives for it. Maybe cynicism would be one. You know. And I've got gratitude and hri, which I might explain later, as positives, and arrogance as a perhaps counterbalance to that. So that's a list. And it's only going to be a partial list. It might sort of give us an idea of the sort of territory we're looking at. But you could go on forever. And in fact, some Buddhist schools did go on forever. I mean, I don't know how many different positive emotions you could come up with if you sat down and sort of... we could go on all day, couldn't we? We could just generate different positives and negatives. But it might be more useful to go to first principles and ask ourselves, okay, what makes an emotion positive? And what makes an emotion negative? So I'm going to suggest that what makes an emotion positive, that positive emotions expand our boundaries. They make us bigger. They make us larger. They open us up to others. They open us up to what is best in ourselves. They open us up to what is good and beautiful in the world around us, in other people and the world in general. So positives open us up, they expand us. Whereas the negatives close us down. The negative emotions, ill will, envy, greed, arrogance, they're all about me, 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 me. They've got this sort of beat that goes on with me, 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 me all the time. They're all about me. They close us down. They make us smaller. They cut us off from others. They cut us off from the world around us. So the positives connect us outwards, increase our sort of range of empathy and identification. The negatives close us down. So I think that, you know, that's my answer to what. What are the positive emotions? They're the ones that open us up. Open us up to others, open us up to the beauty of the world, open us up to even our own sort of higher selves, if you like. Whereas the negatives close us down. So my second question was why? Why do we need to develop positive emotion at the start of the spiritual path? And I think maybe I've just answered it. If the positives are what open us up, make us larger, connect us to others, connect us with the best in ourselves, connect us with the beauty and good in the universe, and if the negatives imprison us in ourselves, well, maybe it's obvious. Enlightenment is all about getting out of the cage of our obsession with our own little self. It's about getting beyond concern just for ourselves, opening up to others, opening up to the world, ultimately even going beyond the duality of self and other, overcoming the duality of self and world. So it might be obvious, it should be obvious perhaps, that the negative emotions are in a way the opposite of enlightenment. The positives are going to be part of enlightenment. And enlightenment is as much about emotion as it is about insight or vision or knowing. The two can't go together. The two go together. They can't be separated. So we tend to talk about enlightenment and insight, but there's a lovely story which we'll actually bring in next week, which is a story of this chap called Meghia, who lived at the time of the Buddha, where enlightenment, in the original sort of translations of that, enlightenment is translated as heart's release. Heart's release. So it's a very different, you know, it's a very different take on enlightenment. Enlightenment is as much about emotion as it is about what we know. And maybe that's obvious, but in the West, here in the West, in the modern West, people are often resistant to the idea that developing positive emotion is essential to the path. Sangharakshita, the founder of the Western Buddhist order, used to often make the point that compared to maybe the majority of people in traditional Buddhist societies, we, modern Westerners, we got very well-developed intellects, very well-developed intellects. But we're often pretty cut off from our emotions. So that as a result, our emotions often stay at a rather undeveloped level. And we often don't want to see that. When we come across Buddhism, we often don't want to see that. We don't want to admit that we've got some work to do in that area. We want it all to be about head, because that's where we're good. So Westerners, we often choose to see enlightenment purely in terms of insight. We see it in terms of knowing about the nature of reality. We see it almost as rational and intellectual. We're often very resistant to practices like the Metta Bhavana. We find them difficult. Maybe we can't see the point. We often see this when we're teaching the Dharma, that some people just find it difficult. They can't see the point of doing those practices. People want to go straight for insight. prematurely, see the goal as purely cognitive, purely about knowing. See it as something that we can know. But of course, it's precisely those of us who have that sort of response to the Metta-bhavana, and I did when I first came along, it's precisely those of us who have that sort of response who most need to work on developing positive emotion. So you might use that as a little guide. You don't like the Metta-bhavana? That's the one you've got to do. Because going for insight without working on the emotions is never going to work. It's a waste of time. You want to waste a load of time? Try and go for insight without working on the emotions. Because insight isn't just something we know. It's a state of being. It's a way of being. We see the world according to our state of being. And our state of being includes our emotions. So we could even say that we see the world through the lens, through the glasses of our emotions. We can all probably think of examples of times that we've seen the world through the lenses of our emotions. We're feeling very negative, we see the world in a particular way. We're feeling very positive, we see it very differently. You can go out for the same walk in the country, try it sometime, go out for the same walk in the country. On one state you think, this is blissful, this is wonderful, what a, you know, the world is this pure land, paradisical place. Another time you go the same walk in the same place and you don't see any of it, or it's just, you know, it's just dull and dark. So, you know, we can think of examples. If somebody is feeling resentful and bitter, for example, they will see reasons for complaint and bitterness everywhere. They'll be blind to the good in people and blind to the beauty of the world, seeing the world through those lenses. If somebody is fearful, they will see reasons for fear everywhere and they won't see the reasons for confidence and courage. If somebody's primary main way of emotionally engaging with the world is sort of grabby and self-seeking, they'll see the world as a place of competition. They'll see everybody else as competitors. They'll see the people who aren't playing that game as losers or mad. Completely blind to the altruism in the world, completely blind to the idealism in the world, thinking that anyone who isn't playing their game must be a failure, or mad, basically, in some way. So we see the world through the lenses of our emotional states. And negative emotions, which come from this cramped obsession with ourselves, are not in accord with reality, because we ourselves are not the centre of the universe, believe it or not. Enlightenment is seeing things as they are. So part of enlightenment is being in the most positive emotional state that we can imagine. Well, actually, it's actually being in the most positive emotional state we can't imagine. It's being in an unimaginably positive emotional state. And that is why we must work on developing positive emotion in order to move towards insight and enlightenment. To try to go straight to insight from some without doing that just isn't going to work. We see the world through the lenses of our emotional states. Positive emotions come from a broader perspective. They give us a broader perspective, a broader empathy, a broader connectedness. They're more in accord with reality. It's quite interesting, isn't it? We see reality more accurately when we're in a positive mental state. When we are in a positive mental state, we see things more as they are. When we're in a negative mental state, we see the world clouded by our own sort of egocentric concerns. So we're going to have to work on enlightenment, on positive state, on being in positive emotion to move towards enlightenment, to move towards clearly seeing. And if we try and skip that stage, you know, go for some really exciting book on some meditation that's going to take us there in one step without doing that, well, it's just a tragic waste of time. It's not going to work. So We have to do it. We have to do it. And I could illustrate this. I could illustrate this with a story. I'll illustrate this with the story of Asanga. So Asanga was a guy, he was a very, very important figure in the development of Buddhism, who lived 300s, 200-300s of the Christian era, sometime around that. And this is a story which I'm sure is true in its essence, but it's told in very mythical Indian terms. Okay? So I'm sure it's a true story, which is then had, it's painted in very bright colours, in very mythical Indian bright colours. So it has all the sort of completely over the top hyperbole and exaggeration that Indian myth goes in for. But it's saying something true, so we need to maybe not gear ourselves to not being put off by the sort of completely over the top way it's told. So in the story, my Asanga, who became this very, very important figure, he took himself off to meditate in a remote cave in the mountains. He worked his way up this totally remote place up in the mountains, where he was determined to stay for 3 years meditating. And in that 3 years, he was going to seek, we are told, a vision of Maitreya. He was going to seek a vision of Maitreya. So I need to say something, maybe, just to explain what that's about. Maitreya is the future Buddha, who is currently sort of biding his time in a higher dimension. He's currently sort of, he's just over there, but he's in a different dimension. He's in a different realm, a different plane of existence, in which he is teaching the Dharma, constantly teaching the Dharma to highly developed beings and to people who can connect with him in meditation. So seeing a vision of Maitreya, in a way, is a mythical way of saying, connecting with a really deep level of reality in meditation. Actually, reaching a point at which we can see through to the truth. We can be taught by reality, by Buddhahood itself. Hear teachings from reality itself. So that's what he was doing. That's what he was seeking. He was seeking to connect with his deep reality, deep truth in his meditation. And that's couched in the idea of seeing a vision of Maitreya. Anyway, he plugged away at this for 3 years, meditating all the time up in his cold, lonely cave, and nothing happened. So he gave up. Fair enough, 3 years, seems fair enough to me. So he gave up. He left his isolated cave, and he made his way down the mountains towards the village. But while he was on his way, well, when he got to the village, actually, he saw a man making a pin from an iron bar by rubbing it with a cloth. And he thought, that takes patience. Maybe I haven't given this enough time. So he made his way back up the mountains, sat down in his cave for another 3 years. 3 years, 6 years now, nothing happened. Nothing happened. So he thought, that's it. That's enough. 6 years enough for anybody. I'm off. He made his way down the mountain and he saw this terrific cleft in the rock, which was made by a single drip, just dripping every now and then. It made this tremendous cleft in the rock. So he thought, okay. Let's not be hasty. Back we go. Back we go up the mountain. If a drip can do that, then my meditation can do it. So he sat there another 3 years, and still no vision of Maitreya. I can't remember what happened the third time, but the third time something else happened, and back up he went, and he sat there for 12 years. He sat there in total for 12 years, and nothing happened. And at the end of 12 years, he decided, well, that's enough. That is enough. He'd spent 12 years in this isolated cave in the mountains, away from comfort and people and pleasure, and it just achieved nothing. as far as he was concerned. So he made his way back down the mountains towards the nearest village with his head hanging down and his tail between his legs. He's going to have to go back and then say, oh, how'd you get on? You know, and he's 12 years. I don't know, a bit of access concentration. I don't know, you know. So he was defeated. He'd wasted 12 years. He'd got nothing. And then just as he was sort of getting into the village, getting into the nearest village, he saw a sick, dying, old she-dog by the side of the road, whose hindquarters were all covered in maggots. And he felt a great rush of compassion. I've told you this is told in very mythic terms. He felt a great rush of compassion, not only for the dog, but also for the maggots. So he thought, I must save this dog, but how can I do that without hurting the maggots, or at least depriving them of their food? So, mythic, he cut off a slice of flesh from his own thigh and laid it on the ground for the maggots. And then he thought, well, I'll take these maggots off this dog and put them on my flesh. And then he thought, well, if I grab them like that, I'll hurt them. So he knelt down and he closed his eyes because the sight was so horrible, and he started to transfer the maggots from the dog to the flesh with his tongue. Mythic. And just as he was sort of reaching out his tongue for the first maggot, there was this flash of, it was just something light, there's real light, and this, you know, what's going on from behind his iris, he could see masses of light. So he opened his eyes, and there was Maitreya in all his golden glory. The dog had turned into Maitreya. And he was a bit taken aback, actually. He was sort of like, he was joyful, yeah, but like, I've been up the mountains meditating for 12 years about you. Where have you been? Why didn't you appear to me for 12 years, and you appear to me now? And Maitreya said, Sangha, I was there all the time. But you couldn't see me, because you didn't have compassion. You couldn't see me because you didn't have positive emotion. You can see me now because you have positive emotion. And he said, if you don't believe me, try carrying me round the village on your back. Now we're at the village. So it's all right. Don't know how you carry my tray around the village. Anyway, he did. My tray was about 15 foot high, golden, carried him round the village. And nobody, so, you know, carries Maitreya around the marketplace of the village. Nobody could see Maitreya because nobody was seeing with the eyes of positive emotion. But one old lady who had some compassion and therefore was the wisest person in the village could see a Sangha carrying an old, half-dead dog and said, why are you carrying that dog? So we can only see the truth, we can only see reality, we can only see Maitreya when we see through the eyes of positive emotion. Okay. We see through the lenses of our emotional states, and the more positive our emotions, the more clearly we see, the more we can actually see the truth. And enlightenment is about seeing with complete clarity. So to move towards enlightenment, we must work on our emotions. That's the whole message of the Maitreya Asanga thing. But you can sit there and meditate trying to have some sort of vision of the nature of reality without positive emotion. You can do it for as long as you like, and you might as well wait for the sun to shine into a cave that points north is often the analogy that's used. Don't even bother. Seek to develop some positive emotion. So we've got to do it. That's why it's the beginning of the path. Integration, positive emotion. Choose not to do it. Choose to waste a lot of time. So the next question then, that's the why. That's the why. So we've done the what and we've done the why. The next question, and the big question is, of course, is how? How do we develop positive emotion? We can't just think, I'm going to be compassionate. Well, you know, I mean, emotion's not quite like that, is it? You can't just summon it up at will. So how, but how in a general sense? Because it's, I mean, you could almost write a treatise on how to do it. You know, it's like the whole of the spiritual life. But first of all, I'd like to say something about how not to do it. Yeah? Because there can be a lot of confusion about this. And the confusion comes because very often positive emotion is very pleasant. So positive emotion very often makes us feel good. It gives us a good feeling. So people can think that cultivating positive emotion is all about cultivating the feel-good factor. It's all about feeling good. But it's not. And this is an approach that leads in the wrong direction. It leads towards sentimentality, and it leads towards a sort of silly kindness. And maybe to really see this, we need to define our terms a bit. We need to be clear about the difference between feeling and emotions. In English, the two tend to sort of get, you know, we use them almost interchangeably, feeling and emotions. But in Sanskrit, it's a very clear distinction. There's a very clear distinction. And feeling in Sanskrit is called vedana. And it's just our sense of something being positive, liking it or disliking it. It gives me pleasure or it doesn't. It's a sort of tingle of, oh, yes, I like it, or no, I don't like it. So vedana is simple. It's quite short term, usually. Something either feels good or it doesn't. But emotions, by contrast, emotions are something much deeper and more complex. They last longer, and they push us into action when it doesn't feel pleasant at all. So positive emotions can feel pleasant, but they may not feel pleasant. Sometimes positive emotion means confronting and doing something very unpleasant. As we saw with Asanga, I don't suppose it felt very positive. Didn't have much of a feel-good factor for Asanga. The old maggots and the rotting hindquarters, there wasn't much feel-good factor about that, but there was a lot of positive emotion in it. So if Asanga had made the elementary mistake that a lot of us make of equating positive emotion with feeling good, there's no way he would have helped the dog in the way that he did. Because that made him feel quite bad, I should think. And we can think of lots of examples of that to distinguish feeling good from positive emotion. So take, for example, metta. So metta can feel great, can't it? It can feel lovely. We do a blissful metta bhavana and we get a lovely feeling. Oh, I love my friend. Oh, they're wonderful. But so maybe because of that metta, we develop a really close friendship with someone. We develop commitment to them. Our friendships deepens, our metta deepens, and then maybe they fall on hard times a bit. Maybe it's not just about going out and having wonderful times with them. Maybe they get ill, or maybe they become poor and needy. And our metta and our compassion then motivates us to stick by them, to maybe visit them in hospital, or to make other sacrifices for them. And that may not feel at all pleasant. But of course, this is an expression of positive emotion. Now, doing these things which may not feel at all pleasant is an expression of positive emotion. If we just do what feels pleasant, that would be mere sentimentality. It would be about me, 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 and my good feelings, not about them. So it wouldn't be about expanding ourselves, expanding our boundaries. Or to take another example, we've had a dog, so we'll have another dog. Maybe we've got a dog and it likes sweeties. Lots of pet discussions going on today. But maybe we've got a dog and it likes sweeties. And it feels good to give our dog sweeties. And it feels good to our dog when it gets sweeties. But it makes the dog fat and lazy and ill. It isn't in the dog's best interest. So positive emotion, real concern for the dog, might lead us to refuse to feed it and take it out for a long walk. Which might not feel good for us or the dog. But it would be what is in the dog's best interest. So sentimentality and silly kindness lead us to give the dog sweeties. And this is all about our own pleasure. It's all about our own feel-good factor. It's about me, 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 not about the good of the dog. It's not positive emotion. You can multiply these endlessly. Say faith, what we call shraddha, faith, confidence, trust. That's faith, confidence, trust. It's not about believing a credo. It's about a heartfelt commitment to moving in the right direction. Something that comes from quite deep and is quite heartfelt. So shraddha, this emotion that gets called shraddha in Sanskrit, it might come up as a big burst of devotional feeling in a puja. It might just, oh yes, I want to give myself to the Buddha. Big burst of devotional feeling. That might feel great. That big, you know, big burst of devotional feeling in a puja, it might feel very, very pleasant. And it might point us in the right direction, but it's not the point. Because real shraddha manifests as a gut feeling that keeps us plugging away, even when it's difficult and when there isn't much pleasure in it. If we want just a pleasant rush of feeling and not the hard plugging away, this is sentimentality. It's not positive emotion, it's about feel good. So, this is how not to try to develop positive emotion, yeah? By mistaking positive emotion for what gives us a pleasant feeling. And this is really, really common. It's a really common mistake. And it doesn't lead to positive emotion, it leads to mere sentimentality, or else to silly kindness that doesn't help others. So how do we do it? How do we develop positive emotion? Well, again, as I said, this is the crux of the whole spiritual life. You could write a book about it. But here are some suggestions, some general points, how to develop positive emotion. So my first one is, I'm going to change that to, I've got follow-up positive emotions. Let's say feed positive emotions. Feed positive emotions. And what do I mean by that? I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. It's a sort of traditional aphorism in Buddhism, a traditional advice to never go back on a generous impulse. Yeah? If a generous thought comes up, I'll give that man a fiver. I'll lend so-and-so my three-piece sweet. I don't know, you know. If a generous impulse comes up, he needs a three-piece. If a generous impulse occurs in our mind, do it. Do it. Do it. Because in doing it, you put your energy behind it, and that strand of yourself, the generous strand of yourself, becomes stronger. If you go back on it, you undermine the generous strand on yourself, and you develop the weak, the sort of stingy strand. So every time a positive emotion comes up, or every time generosity comes up, this is the advice, is do it. Follow it through. Don't undermine it. So that's an example of feeding a positive emotion. Act on it. Follow it through. Identify with it. Make it part of yourself. Go with it. Go with positive emotion. Feed them with your energy. Then the sort of counterpart to that, to feeding positive emotions, is starve negative emotions. So we can't help but experience negative thoughts, negative feelings, negative emotions. They're the product of our past conditioning. They're the product of our past karma. Our past action has made us the sort of person who will feel those things. We don't have a choice about that, but we don't have to identify with them or put energy into them. So, it's an example of that. Maybe, say, you hear somebody you know has just had a tremendous bit of luck. Maybe they've got the best job in the world. Somebody you know has got the most tremendous bit of luck. And this is somebody who already seems to have everything going for them. Someone who's got a much better house than you do, a much better car than you do, a much better partner than you do, a much better job than you do, a much nicer face than you've got, and a much nicer body than you've got. And they have this tremendous piece of luck. And then maybe, just for a minute, a mean little emotion of jealousy sort of pops up. It sort of pops up like a worm from under the stone. And you have a choice then. You can feed the worm, or you can say, "Hi, worm. I'm just off to a shop to buy a card to congratulate my friend." You know, that's starving the positive emotion. Yeah, it's there. Okay, "Hi, worm. Bye." Yeah. don't sort of deny it, but it's there. You know, you don't have to, we don't have to feed it. So feed positive emotions, starve negative emotions. My third one here is cultivate positive friendships, by which I mean cultivate friendships with positive people. For a start, we become like the people we associate with. And secondly, a lot of positive emotion that we're seeking to gather relates to other people. A lot of them are in relation to other people. And we need a positive context to develop that sort of positive emotion. It's very difficult to do with people who aren't positive themselves. But if we have a positive context, friendship with positive people, that's an enormous benefit to developing positive emotion. And what we call spiritual friendship is just an enormously important part of the spiritual life. That's what we're going to look at next week, is the importance of spiritual friendship. And then the counterpoint to that, which will no doubt get some people's hackles up, is avoid negative friendship, or avoid friendship with negative people. This doesn't mean we should only befriend saints, people with halos around their head, perfect people. Okay, we're all flawed, you know. We don't want to be so incredibly choosy. But some environments are infused with negativity. Some environments are just incredibly poisonous and negative. And some people are a bit like that as well. And those environments that are sort of infused with that sort of negativity, well, it's tempting to think we're invulnerable, that we'll change the environment. But it's important to know our limits. We're still beginners. We're not bodhisattvas who can go into hell and rescue beings from their negative states. Actually, we're much more likely to get dragged down. So we need to know our limits. And there's an awful lot of very negative environments that we could put ourselves in, which will have the effect of undermining our positive emotion, feeding our negative emotion. My fifth one here is open up to beauty. Open up to beauty. So, for a start, what about natural beauty, the beauty of nature? Natural beauty can be a really important source of positive emotion. It lifts the heart, it clears the mind, it puts us in touch with reality in a way that being in a city maybe doesn't. So Sangharakshita, again, has said, just even on a simple level, he said, if you want to develop more positive emotion, just spend more time outdoors. Just being outdoors helps us develop positive emotion. But certainly sort of connecting with beauty, the beauty in nature does. But we can also learn to appreciate beauty in art, music, literature, architecture, all sorts of other things. This can give us a lot of pleasure and free us up from looking for pleasure just in things like food and sex and intoxication, which is probably covers quite a lot of pleasure. So the spiritual life isn't about cutting off pleasure. It's about getting our pleasure from more refined sources, from higher sources, coaxing our search for pleasure to a bit of a higher level. So to start appreciating beauty and art, music, etc., can be a really important sort of practice. We might need to actually do a bit of work on it, though, because to use a rather un-Buddhist analogy, a wine analogy, we might need to develop our taste buds a little bit. So we might need to learn to distinguish, using this un-Buddhist analogy, sound wine from merely fashionable vinegar, for example. Or we might need to learn to distinguish good deep wine from superficially juicy, pleasant plonk. But anyway, I'll shut up at that point. Taking that analogy too far, I can see. But exposing ourselves to beauty, opening up to the beauty in all its forms, it's an important part. It's an important way of developing positive emotion. And then we get some really basic ones, like practice the precepts. Who would have thought it? Consciously try as much as possible to stick to the precepts. Simple, good old five precepts. The precepts are guidelines for developing positive emotion. That's what they are. If we live by them, we will start to experience more positive emotion over time. Might take a while, but it will happen. The precepts, they're safety rails. They're sort of safety rails. We're a bit blind. They take us to higher places, but they also stop us falling in all sorts of into all sorts of very unpleasant places. They're protective. They protect us from going places we just don't want to go. They're going to be very negative. So it may not always seem that way. The precepts often cut across our likes and dislikes. They deny us pleasure. Why shouldn't I do that? See, what it's going to feel good. They force us into doing things that don't feel good. Why should I tell the truth about that? But not following the precepts may lead to more pleasant feelings in the short term, but it will lead to fewer positive emotions in the longer term, and therefore less long-term happiness. Following the precepts may lead to fewer pleasant feelings in the short term. In fact, it may lead to more unpleasant feelings in the short term, but it will lead to more positive emotions in the longer term, and therefore to a deeper sense of fulfillment and a deeper, truer sort of sense of happiness. So practice the precepts. And lastly, do the Metta Bhavana. What a good idea. Do the Metta Bhavana. The Metta Bhavana might be the most important practice we teach. The Metta Bhavana is a very important practice. We may not all take to it immediately. It may not give us the same sort of enjoyable, clear, calm state that the mindfulness of breathing does. But it really is an essential practice. It's a powerful practice. It's a necessary practice, because we need to start the spiritual life by developing positive emotion. So I'll just finish off with a quote. It's a quote from Sangharakshita about doing the Metta Bhavana. He says, if you want to develop perfect wisdom, an excellent practice, surprisingly, is the Metta Bhavana. Who'd have thunk it? The enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth. He saw with feeling. What is more, he saw everything as being pure and beautiful. When out of metta you see things as beautiful, you naturally experience joy and delight. And out of that joy and delight flow spontaneity, freedom, creativity and energy. This flow from metta to joy to freedom and energy is the constant experience of the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva's wisdom in the fullest sense therefore includes metta. In a sense, we could even say that metta is wisdom. So developing positive emotion maybe isn't just the start of the spiritual life. Maybe it's actually the goal of it as well.